History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there, stories that we need to hear that should not go untold. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we always learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm in San Jose, California today with 96-year-old Forrest Hilton. He's lived in San Jose for more than 70 years. The Del Monte Canning Company sent him here. But there was another outfit he was working for before that. In World War II, he was a Navy man, and he participated in landings you've heard a lot about over the years, and we'll hear about it from him. But let's start earlier than that, Forrest. What was it like in Pine Bluff, Arkansas? You're an only child? Or were you a busy boy?
I was pretty much a hunter and fisherman when I was a child. I liked to fish and catch a little fish for the table and hunt for opossums and raccoons and squirrels, tree squirrels that we ate. That was part of the diet that we had. And the Depression was on from 1929 when the Depression started, and it was pretty hard to make a living. Some men worked for 10 cents an hour and lucky to get a job. Just wasn't much of work. And we stayed there till around 1937 when we come to California. Our first stop in California to work or look for a job was in Kingsburg. We had a Model A Ford sedan and a little two-wheel utility trailer that we had all of our belongings in. And our first work was cutting grapes, raisin grape, Thompson seedless grapes. We began to get a little money in our pocket. We landed in Kingsburg with $7 to our name. Wow. Did have an uncle in Arkansas that if we got down to where we couldn't eat, he would send us a little money, but he didn't have very much either. But anyway, we started prospering, working in the fruit, picked peaches and grapes, and then we did go to Exeter for olives. Then eventually we ended up in Monterey. My mother worked in the cannery there. It wasn't Del Monte, it was some other cannery. And my dad would hit and miss on whatever he could get. Then along come the war, or the war was in the making, and it was beginning to get some jobs around for getting ready for the war. So we went back to Arkansas, and I had an uncle that had got me a job of learning to operate tractors and earth-moving equipment, because it was building right out of Pine Bluff a large arsenal where they was going to build war machines, artillery and ammunition and stuff like that. So I worked there for a while, and then we had a bad winter that winter, and I decided to come back to California. So I come back, and I had got in the Operating Engineers Union, so I did get a job as a tractor driver. And then the war come along, and I remember you on some of your programs, you'd ask if the person remembered where they were and what they was doing when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Well, I know exactly where I was. We lived in Pacific Grove. A second cousin of mine and myself used to like to go target shooting with a little 22 rifle. So that day, that Sunday, he and I went out in the Carmel Valley and popped a few rounds with a 22. And we come back home. When I drove in the driveway, my dad met me. He said, "Hey, son, we're bad news." "What's that?" "The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor." "Pearl Harbor, where's that?" and he didn't know any more about it than I did. But it was on the radio anyway, and President Roosevelt was making his speeches, and everything was Pearl Harbor. And we were Fort Ord was already built. And my dad worked at Fort Ord building and removing a cavalry outfit. There was a horse cavalry down there between Monterey and Salinas. So they abandoned the cavalry, and Fort Ord was a large fort. training center. And then I didn't go in the Navy right away. I got a job lengthening a runway at the Monterey Airport, and the Navy had taken it over. So we had to lengthen the runway for the airplanes, because it was just a little small, hardly any airplanes flew in there before the war. And I got in a little accident there one night. Everything was blacked out. We didn't have any, you'd have to, as soon as it started to get dark, everybody had to close their drapes, their windows, and turn off the lights, and no street lights in Monterey.
And the reason for people who wouldn't understand this or can't follow you is there's this fear, this concern that the Japanese are going to attack the mainland, and Monterey's right on the coast, so you're turning everything off so you're not a target for the Japanese, right?
That was it. So they and Fort Ord started moving their artillery over to ward off any invasion, and it was a real busy place going on, but in the dark. So I ended up, I was a 1A in the draft, but I had deferment as long as I was working there on that airport. And one night I had everything blacked out, and I run into a truck that had stalled out in the middle of the spread where you'd spread in the dirt. I guess he'd broke an axle or something. I never knew, because I wasn't around much longer after that. And I did hit the side of this water spray truck that would spray the water on our fresh dirt that we was spreading, and kind of lost control of the vehicle. I was running a turnip pole. So the grade foreman, he got all upset and used some pretty bad language to me, and I was just a kid, you know, and so I told him, I said, I don't have to take this kind of foolishness for what you're saying, and I quit. And he told me I couldn't quit. He said, you're froze. If you quit, I'll have you in the Army within a week. So I told him, well, do whatever you have to, but I'm going home right now. And I went home, told my mother, Mom, I got to go. So I went to Salinas, went to the city hall where they had recruiting stations. And first stop I saw, I guess it was a sergeant or something, the Marine Corps, but I didn't want to go in the Army. Something told me not to go in the Army. So this man, he looked up and said, is something I can do for you? Well, and I went over and put my hands on his desk. He told me, get your hands off my desk. Stand up like a man. He said, what do you want? You want to join up? And I told him, no, I just thought I'd stop by and say good morning. And I walked down there, and he told me, come back here. And I told him, well, you can't tell me what to do. I'm not in the Marine Corps now. So now I guess I might have been a little smart aleck guy, kid. So I went down the hall just a little ways, and there was a Navy recruiting station. And there was a man in there sitting at a desk. And he got up and come shook hands with me, asked me if you'd like to join up, and I'd like to join up. So that's the way I got in the Navy. That afternoon, I had gone back to Monterey and left my car, and I got my cousin to take me back to Salinas, where I caught the train to go to San Francisco. The next day, we went through all it, because I already had my physical information from my draft board. So it was pretty easy for that. So I just went in, and so they put us through a more physical and mental questions that they gave me. And so right away, well, there was a whole bunch of us that day. That night, they swore us in, and they sent it by train to Los Angeles that night. From the Los Angeles, they went by bus to San Diego boot camp. I think I was probably about 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks into the boot camp when a man come over. We was out on the grinder marching. So they stopped this march for this man to say what he was there for. And he was asking for volunteers for the amphibious force for the landing craft school at Coronado. So I volunteered, and two other guys, I didn't know them, but they volunteered. They were full adults. They wasn't kids like most of us was. So I went through the landing craft school, learning how to get the boats in to the beach and let the ramp down and bring them back up and get out without being capsized, and back out. You'd go straight in, back out. Oh, it was no, if you could drive a car, a little bit of training and you could master it, you know. wasn't too much to it.
And you said you volunteered. Does that mean no one ever told you you're not supposed to volunteer in the military?
Oh, you have people yelling at you. You'll be sorry. That was a famous saying. You'll be sorry. But we wasn't there too long, 2 or 3 weeks at the most in that training. They did have, I guess, about 4 LCPRs, I think they were at that time. And they had a couple LCMs, the twin-engine tank gliders. So, and the rest of it was all sagebrush and a couple tents. They'd take us over for the day, but they'd usually leave maybe 4 guys there to be on guard duty, for the guard the boats, and make sure that nobody tampered with the boats. They'd just pull them up on the beach. And it was interesting, and I began to like it. And then we went for some training at Oceanside Advanced Marine Combat Training Center. I guess it's Camp Pendleton now. It was just to give us a little ability to protect ourselves in case we lost our boats and on an island there, on a landing. We learned to fire machine guns and throw hand grenades. Because if you lost your boat, you could protect yourself a little bit. You just have to go in with the Marines. But I never lost a boat. And when I went aboard Haywood, I was in 14 different landings. I have 6 battle stars. The ship has 7. But a little bit later on, we went up in the Aleutian Islands. At Attu and Kiska.
Yeah, and I want to hear about that. But you said, you know, you never lost a boat. But I've heard there was something you did lose. All the band's instruments? How'd that happen?
Yeah, well, I was new on that ship, too, just not too long had I been aboard. But we went aboard the ship and on a shakedown cruise, because the ship had been in dry dock in Los Angeles. And they took some Army amphibious training to on landing for the Army from Fort Ord. We went on a little cruise down in south of San Diego and some of those islands. We landed on one or two of the islands, landed those troops on board, and we was learning, too. We finished that little training mission. For some reason, I have no idea why they decided to land those troops at Fort Ord, and that is a terrible surf. That was the worst surf I've ever been in. And, oh, yeah. And, well, I knew it was, because I told some of these guys that went to school with me, I said, you haven't seen anything. If we land out there before it ordered, you're going to be lucky if you don't get drowned. And I was in a LCM, and myself and a crew, and we did have an Army band on board the ship. Anyway, we went to Monterey, whole bunch of ships, and pulled a landing there. And on our last trip in, took a bunch of just miscellaneous load of stuff. And that Army band, those instruments was in that bunch of stuff on that landing barge. So we went in at night, and I wasn't the coxswain of the boat. I was a deckhand. As soon as we got in through that terrible mess in there where the surf was doing to these boats that was already gone in, this boat coxswain said, let the ramp down, and as soon as that ramp hits the ground, start winding her back in. Because you had to crank them in with 2 men on a hand-powered winch to raise the ramp. And said, let the ramp down and start cranking it back up. And can't stay in here very long. And so we let it down when we got on the hit bottom on the beach. And here come a big wave right over the top of us and washed all that stuff out. And there went those instruments in those cases and... But it was dark, and you couldn't see hardly anything. It was terrible. It's a wonder we hadn't all got drowned.
And I'm not trying to be a comedian, but I'm just thinking maybe that's how, you know, when we see these Disney movies and the crabs and the seahorses are playing saxophones, now we know where they got them.
Yeah, that'd be a good chance that they would get I guess the guys who was already on the beach, they retrieved that stuff, I suppose. But it was dark. That was the first time I'd seen Jeeps driving it. There they'd come out of those boats, out of the LCMs, and away they'd go right through the water and up and through the sand. But I never could figure why they decided to try something like that. Day and night, and it took us a couple of days. We lost one off of our ship, one big truck, 6x6, Army truck loaded with supplies for the Army, was bound for Attu. They hoisted it over the side and let it down in an LCM. One of the cables broke, or the hook broke on the truck, and it hung down there with, and it flopped down, and the back end of the truck was down close to the water, and it was just holding it up by the front hooks. They had an LCM there to take it, but they didn't dare try to put that truck in that LCM hanging down from the radiator up. So then they had to cut it loose, and it went to the bottom of Monterey Bay. But anyway, we went ahead and had our landing in Attu. That worked out pretty successful, but the Army took a real beating on, they didn't have the proper footwear shoes, waterproof shoes, and there was snow on the ground, and they got their feet wet, and it was cold, and the fog would be so heavy you could hardly see your hand before you. A lot of these men froze their feet, and they had to have them amputated because they come right aboard that ship. That was a hospital evacuation ship. As soon as we get the troops off of the ship and their supplies off, well, they'd set it up to start receiving casualties from the beach. And we'd have a large surgical staff, and doctors would come aboard the ship just for that landing that we was going to make, and just in case they was needed, in which most cases they were needed, because a lot of casualties from the Marines. We operated mostly with the Marine Corps, 2nd Marines and 6th Marines.
So we all understand your role in this. So you are piloting one of these landing craft and taking those Marines into the beach, and then taking casualties back?
Well, right after Attu, I decided I wanted to get not drive the boat, but be a boat engineer. That was a little more important. Keep those engines running. And I put in to transfer into the engineer's department and learn about those diesel. Well, it wasn't diesel engines to start with. We had Hall-Scott gas engines in those landing barges, 100-octane gas used, aircraft gasoline. And those things didn't work out very well. They'd catch on fire sometimes, and sometimes they wouldn't. You couldn't get them started from that fog, especially when we was up there, when the fog would be so thick that the wires would get wet. Anyway, they started changing them over to diesel, to General Motors 6-cylinder diesel engines, and I wanted to learn those engines. Then I also asked if I could be in the engine room when we was underway, and when we'd go into landing, then I'd be relieved, and I could go back in the boats, and I was in a salvage boat, and that was one that would, we'd go in with the first wave of boats and be there in case anybody got in trouble. But I did stand watches in the engine room, and I learned a lot. Everybody was very helpful, and most of those guys on that ship was reserves from Chicago, from the Great Lakes, and some of them had two hitches in already. They were well-qualified engine people. That ship had four 325-pound superheated steam boilers and two Elliott turbines engines, high-pressure and low-pressure engines, 4,500 horsepower each. I enjoyed everything except going back and checking the bearings on the propeller shaft in the shaft alley when you was in enemy territory especially. We had two guys. I was a port oiler, and there was a down on the second deck down. There was a starboard oiler. We had to take turns on every hour. One of us would have to go back and check the bearings on the main propeller shaft. I think there was 16 bearings, big Babbitt-lined bearings that run in oil. But we'd have to go check them for heat. I didn't like that, because when you go in that propeller shaft, they would close the door on you, and you couldn't unlock it from the inside. After you made your trip and come back to the door, you would just ring a bell. They had a button there, you'd push a button, and the other man would open the door for you and let you out. Then you'd close that door and lock it down again. I didn't like that. That was a little scary. I could see that I'd never made a submarine man.
But there would be even scarier moments ahead for Forrest Hilton in the Pacific. When we come back, more of what he experienced in the Aleutians. And also, November 1943, the Battle of Tarawa. And how he helped save a damaged cruiser the following year in the Battle of Leyte Gulf. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 96-year-old Forrest Hilton of San Jose, California, originally from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and a Navy veteran who participated in 14 landings in World War II. His ship was the USS Haywood, an attack transport that had landed troops at Guadalcanal before Forrest came aboard. He would take part in the Haywood's six other battle stars in the war, including the Aleutian Islands, where he first saw action in May of 1943 in the landings at Attu, and after returning casualties to San Francisco, the Haywood headed north again.
Now, later on, we invaded Kiska, north of Attu. We had taken an artillery piece, I think a 105, and a tank lighter, LCM. They had a weapons carrier towing it. They wouldn't let us land it because it had to go up a hill like that, and it was frozen. They couldn't get traction to tow that gun up that hill until, so they had to get a couple winch cats. Well, the winch cat could climb that frozen place and get up there and run a cable down, and then they could take them. So we laid around there for quite a little while, maybe several hours. Finally, they brought in two D4 Caterpillar winch cats. So we unloaded, and my job was to go down and keep an eye on those engines, but I was afraid that the Japanese might bring a mortar outfit up there and shoot a few mortar rounds down at us. So we had a 50 caliber machine gun permanently mounted on this LCM. So I manned that thing. I was watching that ridge to put a stop to those guys with any mortars coming, sending down to us. So when we backed out, the coxswain backed her out and he started going, and he called on me and he told me, "Hey, Hilton, the engines are getting hot." And I had learned enough about it how to change the sand traps. They had traps down there with the screens to catch sand, keep it from going being pumped up through the heat exchangers. It changed the salt water would go through this thing like a radiator in a car, only use water instead of air. So you didn't want sand getting in that little brass radiators. But you could clean those strainers, but you shut off one, and it would open up the water through the other strainer while you cleaned this one. Well, I went down in the engine room, and I pulled the thing, and he told me, "Hey, there's another one, too, the other engine." Okay, I opened them up wide open. We got it just a little ways, and he opened the throttles wide open because there was a fog bank coming in. We'd get out there in that fog, we'd get lost. We couldn't find our ship. So all of a sudden, bang, 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 first engine went. Blew that engine up. Then just before he could even slow the other one down, it blew up. That cold water from the fresh strainer, and here we was dead in the water. We didn't have any power. And it was getting kind of late, and the fog, here come this fog boiling over us. And we got a tarp and laid it out to try to get a little bit of cover over us, keep some of that fog from soaking us wet, you know. And we set a lookout, and we'd go lay down, we'd try to get a little sleep. And this lookout, he was a radio operator, but his radio wouldn't work. The walkie-talkie wasn't any good. And he woke up, "Hey, guys, get up, something out there." So, boy, we jump up, we get that machine gun all set. Then we heard somebody, "Who goes there?" in English. So, oh, boy, we was happy to hear that. And here they come, one of those old four-piper destroyers, World War I destroyers with a radar. They picked us up on radar because we had put, or CNR had made a detector. They bolted with a pipe and some hardware cloth, made a square like that, about 4 feet on each side. That was for a ship with a radar could pick it up, and if they could get in contact with us, they could guide us back to the ship. But in this case, we didn't have any power. Both engines was torn up. So they took us in tow and towed us back to the Haywood and cast us off real close to the ship. And another one of our boats took us in tow to get it up to the side of the ship where we could tie up. But that was, we could have drifted out there. We were just thinking, but we let our anchor line out, no bottom. That anchor just was straight down. And no bottom, the anchor couldn't reach the bottom. We did put out a sea anchor with a couple of galvanized buckets and tied them and dropped them over them with a couple of galvanized buckets and tied them and dropped them over them and tied them up to the mooring bits on the stern. But that was, we didn't know what we was going to do. Maybe we would have washed ashore at Russia, because Russia was right up there off of that. Or maybe somebody would have found us, but they didn't know anything, because this guy's radio wouldn't. He couldn't get contact with the ship. Holts Bay was on the north side of that too. We landed on Massaquoi Bay. During the night, I think that group of guys was cooks. They went to sleep in their sleeping bags, and I guess instead of having a guard watching, and I guess they all went to sleep, and the Japanese come down through there and bayoneted these guys in the in their sleeping bags. Now, I know the Haywood cooked a whole lot of beans. I don't know where they got them, but they had some big 5-gallon thermos containers that they could make and put hot beans in and hot food. The old cane, the ship that Humphrey Bogart made the movie on, well, that ship was there, and she took that food over to the soldiers over in the Holts Bay area, across around on the other side of where we were in Massacre Bay. Another thing that happened with us there in Massacre Bay to the ship, there was destroyers that was patrolling all back and forth, because the Japanese had a lot of submarines. These destroyers picked up a submarine in the transport area. Well, we had the Haywood, the J. Franklin Bell, the Harris, and the Leonard Wood. So these destroyers zeroed in on the sub, and they started dropping depth charges. They dropped them pretty close to the Haywood, and they loosened some rivets on there. Down below, we had water spraying through little holes for the loose rivets, because that ship was an old ship, a World War I ship, or back in those days. And it wasn't a welded joints. It was all riveted. But we had good, real good bilge pumps, and they could pump that water out faster than it come in, because it was just a little spray. We took those soldiers with the frozen feet, brought them aboard, and they amputated a lot of them on the way back to the States. Some of the guys died from gangrene, but penicillin was pretty prominent at that time, and it saved a lot of people's lives. But a lot of guys lost their feet from frostbite.
Well, and you're taking this in, and you're still a young kid. I mean, you're 20, 21 years old. Did you start to become concerned that something like that or something worse could happen to you?
Oh, yeah. We all knew that at any time we might get it. You know, the ships were being sunk almost one a day or so, or maybe more. The Japanese had a strong fighting force. Their navy was strong. They had us outnumbered on ships and airplanes and big battleships. They had tremendously large battleships. But the U.S. just take over. We just knew we wasn't going to lose that war. You never knew when you maybe wasn't going to see the sun come up the next day. You know, one time we had a ship. We was in convoy with troops. We had a ship cross right across our bow. I was on a mid-watch, a 12 to 4 watch, in the engine room. And so all of a sudden, about 2 o'clock in the morning or so, the annunciator started going wild from the bridge, sending down a message to stop, full astern. And the whistle began to blow, and even another collision siren that I'd never heard before. It started blasting away, so the throttleman, right away, he shuts off his forward throttle and opens up the stern throttle to back down. But you don't stop one of those big ships like that very quick, you know. And you can change your direction of your propeller, but the ship will still keep traveling, you know, for a little while before it'll stop and start backing down. And that annunciator was going crazy. And that poor guy that take down the bells, you had a man they call a messenger. He was in contact with the bridge by phone, but he had to write down everything, those bells, because every time that they changed the setting on that annunciator, engine room telegraph, some of them called them, he had to write it down. Right, and the time, and write down what they wanted, what they was asking for. And he couldn't keep up. And he even had me come over and answer the thing, because you had to answer it. They would ring, and then you had to answer them by doing the same thing with your enunciator. And I had learned how to do that. This guys would taught me a lot after operating of the engine room. So anyway, we finally the ship crossed our bow, and some of the guys on the gun crews on the bow forward gun deck said they could almost have jumped across from one ship to the other. It was that close for us crashing into the other ship. And all that time, we was backing down. So we're lucky that we could back down and let that ship get across in front of us without crashing. And then we get the change to go forward. So Peterson, who was the throttleman, tried to shut off the stern throttle, and he couldn't shut it off. It was locked. He had spun it and had gone up and locked. It went too far. He couldn't break it loose. So he yelled for me to come help him, and I ran to help him, and the two of us couldn't break it loose. But there was a big monkey wrench that was in a little rack on the throttle platform. So I run and got the monkey wrench, and we put it on, and both of us jerking, we finally broke it loose and got it stopped. Well, we finally got the ship things going, and the bridge called. This guy, Teagarden, was a messenger, so he hollered over to Peterson. Hey, that's the old man. He sounds like he's pretty mad. He said for you to come to the bridge immediately. Well, Peterson couldn't leave that engine room until he was properly relieved. I couldn't relieve him because I wasn't a qualified throttleman. He did have a relief, but we had to go get him. And somebody had to go from the engine room, either me or the other oiler from down below on the next deck down. So Peterson told me, go up to the bridge, Hilton, and tell the captain I'll be there as soon as I get relieved. Okay, I'll go up there, you know. And this old man saw me. This guy must have been 75 years old, this skipper, this captain. And he let in on me. He thought I was a throttleman. And I tried to tell him that I'm not the throttleman, sir. And he didn't listen. Threw his hat down on the deck and jumped up and down on it. It blew up completely. His name was Fitzgerald. Finally, the executive officer told him, calm down or I'll have you removed from the bridge. And he calmed down. But anyway, I went down and got the other guy in him. And then Peterson had to face. But he didn't get it like I did because the captain had already been told they'd taken off the bridge. But anyway, we never did hear what caused that ship to cross in front of us, right across our bow. And we'd lucky we didn't back into some other ships that was behind us, because we was out of control, too, after that throttle locked up.
Well, that's the question I have. If you and Peterson had not been able, with that monkey wrench, to jar it loose, what would have happened to you guys?
Pretty good chance we'd have crashed into some other ship, or maybe they could have dodged us, or... Well, the only thing we could have done is just shut off the bulkhead stops from the boiler room, shut the steam off from the boilers over to the into the engine room. They had bulkhead stops, big valves that you could shut off. You just shut off the steam, and the engine would stop. They wouldn't have steam. They wouldn't turn. Yeah, that really scared me more than anything else, I think.
Which is really saying something, because we still haven't heard why he ended up ashore on the island of Betio in the Battle of Tarawa, or how he helped foil a Japanese torpedo plane that was trying to finish off the cruiser USS Honolulu in Leyte Gulf. We'll hear those stories from 96-year-old Forrest Hilton when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 96-year-old Forrest Hilton. A native of Pine Bluff, Arkansas, he has called San Jose, California home for more than 70 years now. But during World War II, his floating home away from home was the attack transport USS Haywood. In addition to his work as a boat engineer on landing craft, he also served in the Haywood's engine room. Today, he's one of the last remaining witnesses of a brutal battle that unfolded in the Gilbert Islands in November 1943, when nearly 1,700 Americans were killed and 2,100 more wounded in just 76 hours of fighting.
Well, Teramo was known to be well fortified, small island. It was only about a mile and a half long and three quarters of a mile wide, but fortified with blockhouses and trenches. There was something that I had never heard anybody mention, was when we got the word that we was going to go there, we was down in New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand. We had been briefed that we had a special time, we was going to land, but just before we was to land, there was supposed to be two waves of B-17 bombers with blockbusters. Now, I've never heard anybody else mentioned that. But anyway, so we got in there with our troops and got up to the line of departure and waited and waited and waited. And the time that those bombers was supposed to be there, there was no bombers. And we waited. And we waited, I don't know, maybe 2 hours or more. And the bombers never did come. And we never did find out why they didn't come. But anyway, the tide had gone out. And there was a heavy coral reef out there. And the tide had gone down, and there was only about maybe a foot and a half of water over the top of that coral. Well, that meant those landing craft barges couldn't cross it. Amtrak's could with the tracks. But finally, Vandegrift, the Marine general, he gave the word, go in regardless of cost. Well, everybody took off, go in. We had five Sherman tanks and tank ladders. Well, they hit the reefs. Everybody hit the reefs. And the boats was stuck, and they couldn't. And that artillery from the beach and was just blasting us something awful. And I was driving an Amtrak. I had gone to a little briefing on North Island, New Zealand, where the Marines had Amtraks, because I'd been a track layer in civilian life. They had a record of what my civilian work was. Anyway, I managed to get across that thing. It killed my motor a couple of times. And there was a Marine major named Crow, Major Crow, 2nd Marine Division. Him and his combat team was in my Amtrak. He told me, take me in about 75 or 100 yards and let us out and get out of here and go back and get another load of Marines. Just as we had to climb over a seawall, a little, wasn't too high, and there wasn't very many people on there had made it to the islands, and just a very few I could see through those little slots in the windshield. And just as I was getting ready to stop, boom, I hit something, or something hit me in the left front track, the sprocket, and it dropped down and started to go around. And one track was dead, and so he yelled, okay, everybody out. So we had to jump over the side. Back in those days, because that was early in the war, there wasn't, we didn't have a tailgates on those that you could let down a ramp, you know, to let the people run out. You had to jump over the side, and so, or over the stern of this thing. So all of us, we piled out of there and run as fast as we could and jump back over that seawall. And then it was a destroyer come barreling in there, and he run aground on the coral. And he couldn't back out, but he was firing every gun he had on the island. Well, we stayed there until the tide started coming in. And then we had to move, because if you stick your head up over that seawall 6 inches, you was dead. They'd blow your head off, because the Japs was in the trenches right close by. I saw one man get his hand blown off with it from a Japanese hand grenade. The thing come bouncing on the ground and the smoke coming out of it, and he reached down and grabbed it and started to throw it back, and it blew up. And he had the poor guy, he had a terrible look on his face. Didn't have many medics in there because they couldn't get in. There was estimated 600 Marines and Navy that was killed before they ever got on the beach on Tarawa. We managed to go to the piers. There was some piers out there, and there was a an old Japanese ship that was run aground and had been burned, and this destroyer started shelling those piers and shelling, and we started walking. Otherwise, we'd had to go up over the top of that seawall, or we'd drown, you know. And the Haywood had their salvage boat. They had managed to get it over there, pretty close to that seawall. And I gave them a big signal, and they managed to ease in there, jump in, and get back out of there. Because the Japs had fire on them, you know. And the destroyer was firing on that pier and the land all around. Well, when you're moving, you know, you don't know what you're doing, really. You're doing things. You have to just, you run, try to do the right thing. But I got in that salvage boat, and that's how I ended up being a salvage boat the rest of the war, all except for Okinawa. They took me out of the boats, and they decided that I guess I had enough. I made a master of arms out of it.
Well, what about there at Tarawa? If that salvage boat wasn't there, what do you think would have happened to you?
Eventually, we would have, we might have got killed, because there's fire going on all over, you know, because those Japanese are very strong and determined. There was 5,000 Japanese Imperial Marines on that island. They figured that they was there. They was going to invade New Zealand. They had 15 years to build that island up, to fortify it like it was.
So you got back to your ship, the Haywood, and then did you have to take more trips in there later in the battle, or?
No, I didn't go back to the ship until the battle was over. I stayed in the salvage boat. Well, we lay there and help guide the boats through that coral, and because they would be boats bringing in Marines and bringing in supplies. Now, during the night, on that first night, there was a boat coming along loaded with supplies from some other ship. They come up to the salvage boat. The boat commander that was in that salvage boat directed on how to get up to the pier. Couldn't guarantee any safety, but the way to go to get up there where there was somebody to take those supplies. I guess they had ammunition and whatever they had called for. So I told them I'll volunteer. I'll go. Because they didn't have a boat engineer. I wasn't very much of an engineer anyway at that time. But anyway, I could help unload that boat. So we got up through there very slow, right along the slide of the pier. And then a guy stepped out. Hey, hold it, right here. It was dark. And there was a long board that was on the pier. And we pulled up alongside, and he shoved that board out, and we put it on the gunnels on the boat and the pier, made something that could slide those case goods. They had all this different stuff. So I helped push those. One guy handed me the box, and I got out about halfway on that board and pulled it around me and slide it up to the another guy, a Marine, that was taking it. But we didn't get fired on. And then we went back, and I gave the officer that was in the salvage boat, I gave him back his 45, because I told him, I said, what happens if there's some Japs jump in the water with explosives and swim toward us? I don't have any weapon. So he took off his sidearm and gave it to me. So when I got back, I gave him back his 45, and I didn't have to shoot it. And there was a lot of things went on, you know, that unless you just try to get out of it. I never tried to get out of anything, but I never killed a Jap that I know of. I did fire. Now, the next day, the Marines come in with flamethrowers, and the only way they could get them out of the trenches and blockhouses, and they'd squirt that napalm up there, and they'd set it off. But those Japs would be firing on these guys. They killed a bunch of them, of those flamethrower operators. I did have an old, I don't know how I come to have that thing, was a Lewis 30 caliber machine gun, water cooled. And I did fire a few rounds to try to help those flamethrower guys to get a chance to try to keep those guys' heads down till they could give them a squirt of that napalm and burn them out of there. They'd come out running and burning their clothes on fire, and then the Marines kill them. I think there was only 3 prisoners of war out of 5,000 men, the Imperial Marines. And we lost a lot of people, too.
Yeah, over 1 square mile, famously called 1 square mile of hell, that battle, that island. And the visuals there were so striking that, you know, they made a documentary film about it. In fact, I've interviewed one of the guys who recorded a lot of that film that actually won an Oscar. And the Marine Corps has that wooden Oscar because metal was so scarce in their Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, Virginia. So if what those images captured on film, if they were powerful enough to motivate America to buy war bonds and feed this war machine, I'm guessing you saw some things that were pretty horrific and that you've probably seen in your memory a few times since.
Well, about the only thing you could, well, you could see one thing, you'd see those battleships at night firing those big 14, 16-inch guns. You'd see those three big balls of fire, red balls of fire coming. And they would hit those blockhouses, and some of them would explode, and some of them would ricochet off, and you'd see a big ball of fire going off into out of sight.
What about when that battle was over? Because it was a pretty quick battle. What did you see then?
Well, we got back to the ship, and black as the ace of spades from the gunpowder been settling down here, you know. So much firepower going on both sides. Well, got back to the ship and kind of settled down. And I never really let it bother me too much. Like I said before, I knew that I might get hit any time, or maybe ship would get sunk by a submarine or something, or maybe even hit a mine or something. Now, we had mine detector stuff on board there with paravanes that they'd put out to cut the mine loose from the cables that had come up. And we put our paravanes out sometimes, but we never did connect with a mine and bring it up. Well, now, one thing that I never got any, well, I wasn't a glory hound anyway, but I made smoke to cover the Honolulu, the light cruiser that was had been hit by a Jap torpedo airplane. So, and that was at Leyte Island in the Philippines. The beachmaster sent a message out to us. We were just a little ways off of the beach with a salvage boat, and said that the ship said, send the salvage boat back to the ship immediately. Okay, we turn and take off and go back to the ship, and maybe about a mile and a half or so out. They already had floating smoke pots in the nets, and they told us to get over there to that cruiser that's burning, put smoke pots out for them, camouflage that ship. And, well, we headed for the ship as fast as we could, and we got over there, and they had a smoke generator, had a little gasoline engine and a blower. You could light it off. I guess it used bunker oil or something to, you'd burn it. It would burn, and that fan and that thing would just blow smoke, all thick black smoke. And right away they told us, okay, go out so far out. They also gave us a radio operator and a little portable radio from the ship. So we got out there, and I made smoke for I don't know how long. It was a few hours, I guess. And that battle, sea battle, Leyte Gulf sea battle, was just getting started. And you could see the flashes of the big guns. We couldn't see the guns, or I mean the ships, but you could see in the big flashes of light. And that Japanese torpedo plane would come through our smoke. He'd looking for that ship, but he couldn't find her, because we had her covered up so good. And they could keep us in contact with if we was covering them or not, you know, and go here and tell us which way to change our course a little bit. And we was on the windward side of the ship, and the wind blew that smoke over them. I did see the Jap torpedo plane a couple times, just for a few seconds, as he'd come through. He was looking for that ship to put another torpedo into her. And finally, we got called in. The radio operator said, okay, the captain says, come back to the ship. So we come back over there, and the only thing we got out of that was, well done, man, from the captain. And that meant something.
And he's giving you a well done, because you guys saved a lot of lives.
They may have been able to shoot that torpedo plane down, maybe, but there might have been more of them. I have often thought about if it hadn't have been that the sea battle was just starting, that Leyte Gulf sea battle that broke the back of the Japanese Navy, that did them in. But if that battle hadn't been going on, those Japs would have probably sent another airplane over there to put us out of commission, because we was prime targets. Here we going along there with the smoke coming right out of our boat and throwing out smoke pots, and they would have probably sent an airplane over there and knocked us out.
Just to make sure I understand and that people listening understand, your whole purpose in being there is to conceal this bigger cruiser, but you guys are pretty obvious because you have a plume of smoke coming out of your boat saying, here we are. If you want to shoot us, we're right here. Here's a big smoke signal for you.
I asked the radio operator. We had a little 30 caliber air-cooled machine gun on that boat. And this guy was coming across pretty not too far away. And I asked the operator to ask for permission if I could shoot that airplane down. And I got a negative on that. Said, fire only if you're fired on. So I guess he was probably afraid maybe I would shoot him down and he might glance right through the smoke and crash into the ship and the torpedo blew him up again anyway. So they didn't give me permission to shoot at him. But I never did really get a good long enough shot. I didn't see him long enough because that smoke was so thick. We'd get lost in our smoke and they'd have to tell us what to change this or change that. And we had a gyro compass on that. You could set your heading and pretty well stay in where you were supposed to go. Yeah, we made it back to the ship, and they hoisted us aboard, and the sea battle was really going on. By that time, it was getting dark. You could see those flashes of those big guns and the bombs, and there was a couple squadrons of PT boats cut across us when we was headed back for the Haywood.
So there you witnessed some of that Battle of Leyte Gulf. I know you would see kamikazes hit nearby ships during the Battle of Okinawa later on, and before that you were part of a feigned invasion, a decoy, or bait, we could even call you, trying to draw out enemy fire during the invasion of Tinian. 14 landings total in the Pacific during World War II. I know you also lost some people that you knew well among those 406,000 Americans who died in the war. And I know you're a regular listener to the show, so you probably see this question coming because I ask it a lot. All these years later, Mr. Hilton, what are you most proud of?
I guess that making smoke for that cruiser and kept her afloat, that would be one thing that saved the crew on that. There were three of us. There was a coxswain on this boat, and this was an LCPR. We did the best we could.
Kind of sounds like something you deserve a medal for.
Well, I never wanted any. I mean, I didn't feel that they owed me anything. I mean, I'm just happy to be able to do what we did and have the blessings that we got to be able to do what we did.
Forrest Hilton, 96 years old. Find photos and a short video with Mr. Hilton online at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of this episode has a few additional stories that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.